Welcome to Beyond the Frontline Podcast, where your hosts, U.S. Air Force veterans, Donna Hoffmeyer and Jay Johnson, will help you transition from the front line to the home front. Listen every other Wednesday, as they will bring great conversations, resources, tips, and feel-good stories that will resonate and relate. Now, here's your hosts, Donna Hoffmeyer and Jay Johnson.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Beyond the Frontline. It's me, Donna, and I'm here with my one and only partner in crime, Mr. Jay Johnson.
Hey, everybody. It's good to be back. I just have one question. Why do I get referred to as partner in crime? You create the crime, and just because I'm with you makes me your partner?
He'd like to think that. I usually get dragged into more things because of him.
That's true, not actually. Not let him fool you. But all of mine are legal. Just to be clear.
Oh, Lord. I'm going to tell you, the tides are turning right now, because when this all started, the podcast, you were the straight-laced one, and I was the one cracking the jokes. And now slowly.
Is the tide turning?
The tide is slowly turning.
I don't know. Look, the listeners, if they are dedicated listeners, they know, Donna. They get to listen to all these. So because we've got a queue built and some haven't even been released, all they know right now is the physical evidence portrays you as the instigator.
I'm soon to be the queen. Don't forget that.
I'll keep that in mind. What's happening with you?
Oh, Lordy. Well, like you were talking about, spring has sprung and I'm springing everywhere and you're springing every other
direction. I'm springing leaks is what's happening right now. I can't hold any more in.
We are off and running between our businesses and doing chamber stuff and library stuff and family and there's nothing bad. I was telling that to my husband this morning. I'm like, how can I feel like I can't catch a breath when there's nothing bad? Like, why should I be sad?
It's a good feeling, right? Well, yeah,
sort of. I mean, my cup runneth over, like you said, but my Lord, it's good though. We're good.
That's what I always say.
I just got to get on top of the ball and just not let it run me over.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I always say. I mean, you get to hear me kind of vent and talk about all that's going on and who's responsible for that. Me, because I said yes to these things or agreed to these things, but
think them up.
That's true. Creating. But I still believe this. I'd rather have my hair on fire than sitting idle any day of the week. Mm. You know, if I have my choice between the two, give me where I'm currently at all day long, any day.
It's just been a lot of like up and down stuff. That's what it's been, like good things. Like I'm working on a project right now. Mm. And so we need team members. And so I had all the team members and then I lost a team member. And then I thought I was getting the team member back today. And 15 minutes before the meeting, I didn't have the team member anymore.
Welcome to the times we live in.
And then 30 minutes later, I think I have another team member. Yeah. I think the roller coaster is just wearing me out there.
It's crazy. Well, all I know is it's starting to heat up and warm up here in this part of the world where we live. But I'm heading out this weekend for Alaska. And yeah. I think they are
cool. Right,
they're off. Starting to experience their melt. Yeah. So, you know, by the time everybody listens to this, it's well into their good season where they're outdoors fly fishing. They probably do that year round anyways.
You bring your long johns?
I'm going to have to pack some.
Yeah, you know? You're going to be cold up there, Southern boy.
Yeah, it's going to be a little chilly, but it's going to be a good trip. And speaking of which, since I said fly fishing, there always seems to be something that rolls out. Yes. Like that tees up who we're going to talk to today, because our guest today is an avid fisherman.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He's a lot of person.
An international man of mystery is what I'm going to say.
His bio is long, but we're going to summarize it. You'll see the whole bio in the summary of the podcast, but it is beyond impressive. So I'm just going to set the scene for everybody, is that Jay is going to introduce our guest, but I'm just going to tell you that the focus of the podcast today is to talk about how things are always changing. So, and we have to stop and remember that sometimes when we think things are crappy or not good, sometimes we have to look back and reflect and see how far we've come, which is what I've had to do recently, that yeah. I've come far, but boy, you know, I have to slow down and remind myself through all the chaos that it started rougher. So we're going to apply this to transition.
Yeah, there's always an opportunity to find something to be grateful for. Yeah. So
and we want to show our veterans specifically what transition was like 30, 40, 60, how many years ago? Well, Vietnam era.
You're going to make him upset and he's going to leave.
Yeah. Careful there.
Okay. Haven't even introduced him. You hear him?
I'll let you introduce him and we'll go from there.
Yeah, it's all good. He understands. I know he understands. understands. Well, look, Mike Clark, everybody, is our guest. And, you know, we have him on video screen. We know you're still getting just the audio portion of this, but Mike is somebody that is near and dear to Donna and I both. We know him through a local chamber of commerce. I've actually had the pleasure of calling Mike a friend. I'm going to guess somewhere in the 6-year range.
Yeah,
I know his family, his wife, Jan, his daughter, Tammy, and they have a son, Mike, as well. But Mike did enter the military in the Vietnam era, helicopter pilot, retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Army. After the Army, he did many things, but I'm going to focus just briefly. He's an educator at heart, so he taught in the school systems. He was a principal, a superintendent the last 7 years of that part of his life. This guy doesn't slow down, by the way. I consider him a mentor. He's somebody that I watch, and there's so many things he does in the way he speaks and communicates with others that I want to emulate. Today, he's involved in about everything I'm involved in, or I'm involved in everything he's involved in, probably because I like being around him. But he is the president of a Kiwanis club here in the Central Texas. We call it the Hill Country region. And I'm a member of that organization. And I just really love their heart for service in the community, particularly around youth causes. And we raise money for scholarships and other things.
That's
so
awesome.
Without further ado, we are excited, elated to have a conversation with Mike Clark. Mike, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Looking forward to it. It's interesting just listening to the, what do you call it, coming into this whole thing.
The banter.
Yeah. I was getting myself into there for
a No, you're good. You're in a safe place. You know, Don and I.
Okay. I do.
We have fun. Donna and I have always said, Donna says this routinely about, you know, we don't script anything. It's really true. We bring topics in, Mike. We bring people in. We really want it to be, these are Donna's words, coffee talk. We're just sitting around a table together communicating as friends. And hopefully that resonates through what we do.
Yeah, we really have no interest in scripting out stuff. We want to pick your brain for your knowledge, your experience, your wisdom. And we just want to sit and talk. And I always tell people the beauty of it is Jay and I are just curious as ever. And we'll ask tons of questions. So this is really just about getting to learn more, right? Across the board.
Yeah. So Mike, the reason we reached out to you, and I'll tee up, you know, something for you to share here with us, but in the opening of our podcast, where it just talks about our main focus, helping veterans transition from the front line to the home front, one of the things we talk about is feel-good stories. And we've done a lot of things, some of them lighthearted for sure, but we haven't really taken the time to do what we're about to do in this session. And so, Mike, number one, from both of us, thank you for your service. We both recognized at the time you entered and served in Vietnam era, especially, very different than the world we are in today, the way service members are viewed today. So what was it, Mike, for you growing up that led you to say, I want to serve our country? Was it your choice, or was it, you know, maybe it was another?
No, it was my choice. As long as I remember, I always wanted to be in the military. I come from a military family. I think as far as I can trace, from the Revolutionary War forward, there's been someone in my family that's been involved in that. And I guess I kind of picked it up. I was the only one. There were three boys and one girl, my siblings, and I was the only one who came into the military. Now, having said that, my brothers went to law enforcement for years, but something I always wanted to do. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot flying off a carrier. But back in those days, at least in the mid 60s, I graduated high school in 65, tried a little bit of college, and that didn't work. So I knew doggone well, since that didn't work, I was going to get a note from Uncle Sam real fast. And then eventually we worked my way through, got commissioned, went to flight school. So I got at least the flying part, but not flying fighters off of carriers, which is what my dad did along with that. So that's how I ended up in the military. It's something I knew I was going to do, wanted to do that forever.
So you were a helicopter pilot, right? That's what you ended up.
I was dual rated. I have fixed wing rated as well in the military, but 90% of my flight time is in helicopters, which I enjoy flying much more than fixed.
What types, Mike, just for listeners who may have a connection with you? What did you fly?
Going through flight school, first helicopter I ever flew, if you want to call it that when you first try something like that, was an old Hiller H-23. And then got to that was at Fort Walters, Texas. And then we went into the advanced phase and in the instrument phase and flew a Bell 13. H-13, or kind of the old bubble thing you see on MASH, if you ever watched that.
Yeah.
And then transitioned into Hueys. And then right after flight school, I was one of three, I think, from my flight class that were, I will say, picked, for lack of a better term, to go to Chinook transition and ended up flying Chinook.
Yeah.
most of the time.
I remember Chinooks, Mike, because you and I've talked about this. I grew up in Lawton, Oklahoma. Fort Sill is there, and I used to watch Chinooks fly in and out of Fort Sill all the time.
Wasn't my choice. I didn't want to fly Chinooks, and I called aviation branch. Well, we didn't have an aviation branch. I called the field artillery branch, which I was commissioning at the time. I want to go to Chinooks. So we don't care what you want to do. This is what you're going to do. I wanted to fly Hueys and fly gunships and stuff. That's all I thought at the time was the fun stuff. But I got in enough trouble with the Chinooks, so.
What were you flying when you were in Vietnam? Were you in the Chinooks?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I did. Both tours.
Wow. What was your primary mission when you were in Vietnam, when you were flying the Chinooks?
Well, the Chinook mission, I was with the 1st Cav Division, 1st Cavalry, Air Cavalry Division, my first tour in Vietnam. And the primary mission of Chinook was the hauling supplies and all kinds of stuff to keep the ground forces with what they needed. But the 1st Cav had a unique plan for Chinooks. We flew combat assaults as tail end Charlies with the Hueys going in the landing zones, which was really not all that great. The Chinook is not very maneuverable, especially when you're on approach or on departure. And the bad guys figured that out pretty quick, and they let the Hueys come in and let us come in before they got serious about wanting us in there.
Wow.
But after a while, the CAF quit doing that. And we primarily did a lot of resupply stuff, did medevac stuff. If somebody needed a medevac and wasn't anything else around, we'd go in and get them. And that was the same thing with the second tour. I was at the 101st Airborne. My second tour did the same stuff.
Oh, wow.
How many total tours, Mike?
Two.
Two.
I know two just in side conversations. On one of those tours, I think one of your children were born, I think. Is that true? You were?
Yeah, between tours. When I came home from my first tour, I was assigned to Fort Rucker, Alabama as an instructor pilot, Chinook instructor pilot. And also right after I came back in early August of 69, and Jan and I were married at the end of August. And then the following, see, when was he born? 1971, in July of 71, our son was born. And I came down, he hadn't anymore been released from the hospital. Orders came down and sent me back to Vietnam. But I talked him into, he was 6 weeks old when I went back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was a labor and delivery nurse. I was a flight nurse. I've done a little of everything. Mm-hmm. I remember for a period of time when I was working labor and delivery, we had Army wives coming in to have babies. And I remember this lady saying to me, you know, my husband will see the baby when she's 9 months old. Because this is when they were hitting those 18-month tours in deployment, yeah. The high time there. And I was like, wow. My husband missed my son's birth by 4 days, and he was deployed a couple months after my daughter was born. So yeah, I feel you on that one.
Yeah, it's certainly a unique part of service, isn't it? You know, I think when civilians say, oh, y'all are paid well, and you know, y'all get X and Y, but they don't understand the disruption in the life of having to constantly pack up everything you own and go somewhere else, you know, every couple years, and then missing significant events like this. Most people in corporate America, they don't experience that.
No, not even close at that.
No.
What did you have a lot? Did your wife have a lot of support when you were deployed? I mean, did she have?
Not really. I mean, she moved to Phoenix, where my folks were, and I had my family there. So from that perspective, yeah, she had that kind of. See, the second tour, she had some pretty decent support. That she had folks she could reach out to, and she wasn't alone. Let's put it that way.
That's good. Yeah, that's a big thing.
You know, Mikey, I don't know. It just weighed on my spirit. I just feel like I need to say it. I actually met you through Jan. I know I met you in the leadership program, but prior to that, my very first chamber event was a luncheon, and I walked in late, found a table, sat down, and it was your bride sitting next to me, and she was so welcoming. It really made me feel like I was part of the group, and that was one of the things that really led me to get more involved, honestly. So
yeah,
kind of neat when I think about the relation back to how I got to know Mike.
That would be Jan.
Yep, that's true.
That is spouses, the backbone of the military. A lot of people.
She is not on a government pension like I am, but she's as much retired soldier as I am. Of the 26 years I was in the military, she was with me for 23 of them.
And an educator herself. Right? That's something y'all share in common as well, education.
So when you deployed the second time, what was you were a Chinook pilot, but were you in charge of anything? Did you have troops with you? Were you just flying as a pilot yourself?
No. By that time, they weren't sending whole units over in, you know, together. I was just a replacement coming in. I was a captain at the time, and I didn't pick up any command responsibility until I got assigned to the unit.
So when you retired, what was your role in retirement?
My last job as retirement was a professor of military science at New Mexico State University.
I love that. There's something we have in common, right? Because I was a commandant of cadets at Auburn.
But yeah.
What was that like, Mike? How many years did you get to serve in that capacity?
I was there for a little over 2 years before I retired, and I enjoyed it. And I had never done anything like that before, because all my jobs before that were all combat arms related and doing things. And the job I had before I went to New Mexico State, I was a strategic nuclear operations officer, and our job was to blow up the Eastern Bloc whenever we needed to. It's a whole different story, but I enjoyed meeting the kids there. I guess one of the downsides of it, if you want to call it that, I was a department chair in the College of Arts and Science, and Dr. Renee was the dean of the college, and he called me and says, you know, one of your jobs is to be a counselor for incoming freshmen that are have not declared a major. I found that to be an eye-opener. And because a lot of those kids came in, they were there to party and have a good time and spend daddy's money. And I got in a little bit of trouble because I told a couple kids, why are you here? To spend money and your dad's money and partying. So I had to kind of tone that down a little bit. But working with the kids in the cadet battalion, they were dedicated young people. And even during that time, talking the late 80s, early 90s when this happened, and things were going on in the Mideast and that kind of good stuff. And of course, you know, the first Bush sent some folks over and to do some things. But having said that, we did not have a lot of campus unrest against the military, which was, you know, knock on woods. I was fortunate there because some of my contemporaries that had the same job at other campuses around the United States faced some real challenges with certain organizations on campus that didn't want them there. I didn't see that in New Mexico State. But the kids were great. I enjoyed lots of questions. And yeah, we had a curriculum we had to follow, but I never missed a teaching moment, if you would.
I don't think what I'm about to say is unique to just one university where I was at, because I loved my time there and it's a fantastic university. But I would tell you on occasion, Mike, I had some of my college students who were in the Air Force RTC program come back and tell me that they felt they were being disadvantaged because of their affiliation with us by some of the professors on campus. And there were a couple occasions where I went and had a sit down conversation. I don't think I made any headway on their behalf whatsoever, but I was willing to stand up for these men and women who, from my perspective, had tremendous values and were willing to stand behind what this nation represents. And I thought it was very unfair for them to be given grief. That's what I'll call it, by some of their profs.
That's interesting because this is different time frames for you guys.
Yeah, that's right.
But I taught college for a couple of years. I worked in the kinesiology department, and I had students that were reserves, guard, all that. And, you know, maybe it was because my military background, but if they came to me, it was an immediate, how do we work this out for you? There was really, and the department environment was all of that.
Like, very supportive.
If the military students are coming up against an issue, you know, work to their advantage, help them out. If you're stuck, go to the department chair, which I never had to do. I mean, it was pretty easy to make up a test or homework or whatever, but that's just interesting. It wouldn't have even crossed my mind to think that there would be a bias against the military. But it kind of leads into what my next question is. So after you got done that, you know, last job, and then you're retiring, did you take how was that? Because that's really like the big question. Did you take a break? Did you go right into a job? What happened at retirement?
I was offered a job before I retired. Believe it or not, my brother and his partner, they now own about 58 subways, and they also at the time they didn't have that many, but they also had a real estate business. And just so happens that their controller had moved away, got married, moved away, and they were looking for somebody to keep their books. Well, I'm not a mathematician, I'm not a CPA, and I'm not an accountant for that matter, but I can add and subtract. You know, I had an engineering degree, so I was somewhat good with math. So I worked with him for a year doing that. They only had 3 subways at the time, so it was easy to take care of that. But I got a call from the Department of the Army to tell me that there was a junior ROTC program that they were trying to start at a place called Dysart High School, which was on the west side of Phoenix. And would I be interested in looking into that? I had never given it a thought. Now, Jan, as Jay noted, has been an educator all of her life. And of course, I had that opportunity to teach at New Mexico State, and I found I liked it. And I enjoyed working with the kids. So I investigated it anyway. I ended up starting a new junior ROTC program, became a high school teacher. And that's how I got into the education.
I almost did that.
Was, you know, I walked out of one door and essentially a year later, I put the uniform back on.
So, go ahead.
I almost did that, Mike. Just again, another parallel, you know, mm-hmm. I do have very similar experiences. I actually applied to be a junior ROTC lead instructor and was offered the job. But 2 days before they made the offer, I accepted a government civil servant position at Randolph. So by the time they called to offer me the job, they were a few days late and the dollar short. So I ended up not doing that, but I thought that was cool. Can I back up just a moment?
Sure.
So, you know, one of the things Donna and I talk about often, Mike, are, you know, today all the services are congressionally mandated to have a transition assistance program. And there's a couple variations to that you may or may not know. There's TAP, which is primarily, I would say, captains and a lot of enlisted, but you know, they allow some of the chiefs, the E9s, the E8s can go to ETAP along with senior officers, field grade and above. So they call it ETAP. Did they have anything available to you as you were retiring out of uniform to kind of help you ease, or anyone, even those you served with, to ease into civilian life?
No. Nothing. I processed out and retired out of Fort Bliss, Texas in El Paso, which ironically enough is the same place I went to basic training and where I started.
Full circle.
Some years earlier. Yeah, closed the circle. But there was nothing that was offered or that I was aware of. Now, having said that, I didn't research it because I wasn't too worried about it at the time. But no, when did I retire? October 1st. So September 30th, I was a active duty lieutenant colonel, and the stroke of midnight at one October, I was retired. And I just, bye.
Everybody waving at you as you leave the post?
Yeah, I didn't even wave. I just walked.
That's my retirement date is 1 October yeah. also.
Yeah.
That's funny. And mine was the same way because it was COVID. It was September 30th. I was October 1st. I woke up and that was that, you know, I was out.
Yeah. That same thing here, you know, it's just another day in the life going on.
So for that year before you got back into the uniform, where you were doing the subway gig as.
Yeah, I was doing, keeping the books.
And what was going on with you, as in you internally, what was going on with you after retirement? Because, you know, a lot of people saw me and they're like, oh, look at you all retired. And I was kind of caving in on the inside a little bit, you know, like I was like, I don't know what I'm doing right now, but I'm taking a breather. So what was going on with you internally?
I don't think I felt like I was caving in or anything like that. I had another job to do and I went to work. I just wasn't wearing the uniform and I wasn't worried about all the things that a lieutenant colonel had to worry about with the 300 cadets that I had in my program and all the other stuff behind me. I had to worry about making sure Subway got their Subway stuff at the store and the employees got paid. That was, and that kept me busy.
Did you find yourself, you know, missing anything? Or I guess what I'm trying to get at is like when you're under, like in the military, what I found is like when you're under that constant go and that constant mm-hmm. pressure, we're just used to it. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. what we do, you know, like you're juggling things, you have that constant pressure on you, and then you get out, and what you don't realize is, like you said, that pressure alleviates, and then it doesn't happen immediately. It might be 6 months, 8 months later. But were you noticing things with you that a lot of us just kind of tuck it away and go, okay, you know, is what it is? But you had made a comment when we pre-talked that you started noticing that you were having some issues, and we don't need to get in details on it, but what I was trying to get at is, did you start noticing things since you had no pressure and time to think that was going on with you post-military?
Yeah, I guess there probably was to some degree some things I hadn't thought about in a long time where I thought about them.
Right.
And because they're just, there was a lot more time to, I guess, let my mind roam around. Wasn't so focused on getting X done by Y time, if you would. And
right.
All that kind of good stuff. So I hadn't really thought about it like that, Donna, but now that you mention it, yeah, looking back, you're, yeah.
I know for me, Mike, I really, it was just a closing of a chapter in a book and I was going to start another one. I missed the camaraderie, I guess, a little bit because mm-hmm. we served alongside of men and women that shared our values. And we don't always find that out in in the corporate America world, if you will. But so I missed some of the relationships. But I think, you know, maybe what Donna's hitting on too, I don't know if y'all will agree with this, but our identity gets heavily wrapped up in that. And so transitioning out of uniform into this new place is, it can be a lot of uncertainty. And one of the things that we're trying to do on our podcast is not only equip them with tools and things to think about to help them in that regard, but if necessary, even to connect them with other people who can assist them. But I miss the camaraderie a little bit, Mike, when I left.
Yeah, that's true. And I saw a thing, I don't remember where I read it, where you kind of, things are different from when you're on active duty military versus in the civilian sector. You're on the Army post or wherever you happen to be stationed. And in my case, happened to be a lieutenant colonel. Now, that's not real senior in grade, but it's worked its way up there a little bit. And people see you coming as a lieutenant colonel, and they respond the way they're supposed to, just like I did when I responded to general officers when I worked with them. And then you get up, you walk out the door the day you retire and go down the street again, and nobody cares. I mean, it's a whole different scenario. And the thing I read had to do with a gentleman that was a greeter. Now, is this true or not? I don't know. I think it is. Was a greeter at Walmart, but he had the habit of not getting there on time. I don't know if he saw this or not. But finally, his boss accosted him and he said, you know, you need to be here on time. He said, you know, what happened? You know, what's different? How do they treat you in the military? And he said, well, I walk in the door and the folks in there say, here's a cup of coffee, Admiral.
I remember reading that one.
Did you read that, Donna? No. Then they showed his picture next to him and he was an admiral. I mean,
I've never seen that. That's awesome.
I remember reading that. Yeah. I started smiling when you said it because I knew.
Yeah. So that's kind of what it's like. Now, I'm not a retired admiral, retired general, but when I'd walk into the battalion area, the first day I walked in, especially when I commanded a helicopter company, the first time I walked in the early room, they call attention.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you hadn't have told that story because now Donna's going to expect me to hand her a cup of coffee every time she steps into the studio. So, yeah.
Well,
might happen. But that's kind of the way it was in the transition from the military to the civilian side of that.
Yeah. What did you see? And I relate. And it's funny when you say that because I can seriously hear people go, oh my God. So because you were an officer, you expect, and I'm like, no, that's not it either. It's not an expectation. It's just the culture that you're in, things are happening. And then you come out of that culture, different things are happening or not happening. And you're like, oh, it's not like you walked in and was like, expected it, or the admiral expected any of that. Was the way life was. And so I totally understand that. What do you see did you see your friends? You know, Vietnam was obviously very traumatic for many people. Mm-hmm. What did you see with your friends and buddies coming out of the military or coming back from deployments and retiring or separating? What were you seeing with all of that?
Well, the Vietnam era guys, that when they if they stayed in after Vietnam and retired, you know, in the early 90s, like I did, they seemed to handle it pretty well. Some of the folks I knew that came back from Vietnam and were immediately discharged, it was a whole different story because it's, you know, you walk out of 24 hours ago, you were dodging bullets. And then all of a sudden you step off the airplane in McCord Air Force Base or San Francisco International. And that, I mean, they'd never had time to decompress.
Yeah.
Is what I might say, because they're just thrown out there in the civilian sector with nothing to transition them into that particular world. Where I had time, and I kind of referred to this earlier, that my second tour ended in September of 72, but I stayed in the military and along with the other guys, and we had that whole time from 72 to 92, if you would, in my case, where we continued doing military things and were able to talk to fellow vets that had been through similar things. were able to decompress over that 20 years. So when I walked away from the military, I didn't carry that baggage with me.
You know what, Mike, there's an organization all around the U.S. called Honor Flight, and yeah. I used to serve in that organization. But I went one time, Mike, as a guardian is what we were called. And at that point, they were heavily focused still, and probably still are, on World War II generation, because there's still some of them out there, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then we look at it, you know, from Korea and then Vietnam. But a lot of the people that service members that we were taking to Washington, D.C. on these honor flights to let them see the memorials that stand in their honor, many of them were Vietnam vets. So I went one time as a guardian, which meant I had a Vietnam vet that I was assigned to, and I assisted him everywhere that we went. And when we came home to San Antonio International, and I watched everyone stand and greet them and applaud and wave flags and tears flowing, the veteran I was with broke down and cried. And he and I talked on the side, and he said, I never experienced that when I came home.
No.
And I knew in that moment, Mike, that was going to be in an organization that I was going to be a part of. And maybe that's a future podcast, because I still know the people that run it. But Mike, I think to Donna's point, we both recognize that in that era in particular, that the way servicemen and women were treated was very different.
Yeah. Did you feel that coming in this? I mean, yes, we're in the military, but we do live in the civilian world too. I mean, communities. So did you feel that, or your friends feel that, when you had to interact with the civilian community?
Not very much, no. I stationed at Fort Campbell and Fort Hood and places, exotic places like that.
Yeah, exotic.
That's a good word
for it. Although I did have a tour in Hawaii and I had a tour in England, so I can't complain. But I never really felt that from the civilian sector, maybe because subconsciously I was avoiding being put into situations when I might. I never went to very many, if any, civilian type functions where I would have to associate with someone that might think a little bit differently.
I got you.
Having said that, when I was at New Mexico State, because I was a department chair, I went because it was expected of all the department chairs to once a year, the president of the university opened his house and had a cocktail party, for lack of a better thing. Yeah. And but even at that, at New Mexico State, I never felt any, well, we'll use the term the kids use, negative vibes from any of the other faculty. So and same when I go to the department chair meetings and stuff with Dr. Casillas, I never felt that. So I, from that perspective, I lucked out. Now, my office was right across the street from the president's office. And I get a call once in a while from his secretary. He said, you have a couple minutes, Colonel Clark? Yeah, what's up? And I go over and have a cup of coffee. And he was a nice guy. He liked the military. That may have had something to do with the climate on the university.
Too. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm very fortunate, man.
Well, you just made an interesting comment. It's what piqued me up when you were like, I also might have been very cautious and avoided certain scenarios, wasn't put in that situation. And it brings me back. So when I taught college, and when my husband was stationed in Arkansas, and I got an opportunity to do, essentially, it was like a clinical rotation. I got to go check out like a geriatric center, and then I got to go check out the VA there. And one of the departments I got to work in, the VA, I got to watch a mental health, I think it was a psychiatrist, give a series of testing to a Vietnam vet and go through some different testing. They were basically evaluating him for PTSD. What fascinated me was that he himself had no awareness that all his sleep issues, sleeping in a recliner, him hiding behind a recliner when a thunderstorm was going on, he did not connect any of that to his Vietnam days. And it was fascinating to watch them, what I would call like peel the onion. So they started very general, and then the questions started to get more specific. And as they got more specific, and he was connecting these relations to see how uncomfortable he was getting, it really was fascinating. And so, you know, that the statement, ignorance is bliss, and what is kind of interesting is that I think that statement was almost a protective factor in some senses, you know, to people, but in another sense, nobody knew that they actually needed help. And I think I told you before we started the episode, Mike, that my great uncle was one of the guys that went right up the face in Normandy for D-Day. And he was just known as the drunk uncle. And I'm, you know, here I am all of 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And then now I'm in the military, going through the military, looking back. I mean, he has passed away since. But looking back going, oh my God, he just had very severe PTSD. Yeah. But that's just the way it was. And they just kept going.
It was kind of like that when back in the 60s and 70s, those guys and gals coming out of Vietnam, the Army nurses there, they faced trauma every day. And I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect they never got any kind of counseling or help, I doubt.
No, we're better today in that regard for sure.
I hope so, because
better doesn't have to be better. Yeah. Better, not best. You know, we still got work to do, but certainly better.
You don't have to be shot at to have trauma in a situation like that.
Did you ever look back and realize that you were coping? I mean, what you just said there a little bit ago about picking where you went is a coping mechanism, but did you ever notice anything else where you now can say I was coping?
No, I didn't know I had issues until my wife told me I did.
That happens a lot, though.
She's been hinting at it for a number of years, but it's only been in the last 4 years that she hinted at it more strongly, and I had no idea. And I went to the VA and said, you know, my wife thinks I have issues. I don't think I do, but she does. And come to find out, I had some issues that I hadn't thought about. And the psychiatrist did the same thing he just talked about. And I mean, I don't probably have them the rest of my life, but I know how to deal with it.
You have tools now.
I won't go postal on anybody if you would.
Yeah, that's right.
What that term means, you don't know.
Yeah, I remember. Look, I'm an Oklahoma boy, so I know where that term came from when you said because that has connections back to Oklahoma.
Yeah, so it's not just me. It's anybody that I would assume our emergency or first responders have the same kinds of issues. They see the same kinds of stuff all the time.
Yes.
Hey, Mike, what are you most proud of when you reflect back? I mean, what really touches your heart when you look back over your time in uniform, your service?
Well, I had never thought about that.
We come with the hard questions.
What am I most proud of? You know, that could fit in about 78 different categories.
Sure. Just pick one. What's something that still warms your heart when you think of it?
Probably a medevac I flew. And we pulled 9 guys out of a very bad situation and pulled it off successfully. And we got the living daylight shot out of us. Having said that, we all got out. None of us got hurt. And we got the kids back into the 90th Evac Hospital. And
that's amazing.
They all lived. So from that perspective, I guess, I'm pretty proud of the whole crew. Because when the call came out for an urgent medevac, you know, we listened. Normally a Huey would do that. But there weren't any around. We were the closest helicopter around. And I asked the crew, I said, guys, you heard what's coming on. Is it okay if we go in? You know, I had 5 other guys back there that I needed to worry about besides me. And they said, let's go. We did.
It's funny when you said that, because what came to my head when you were like, you know, we went in and we took them out and we got all shot up. And my thought in my head, and you, as you were saying, you know, we all survived. I'm like, yeah, but did you die? You didn't. So it was good.
Yeah.
Even that's our mentality. When you said that, it was exactly, you said that in a much more eloquent way than did you die? But you just said, hey, you know, we all got out. So it was a good mission.
Yeah.
You know, we don't appreciate that we had a lot of trauma with it.
There's a really amazing Billy Joel song called Goodnight Saigon. I don't know if you've ever heard it, Mike.
I've heard it.
Might be tough for some people, but I think it really captures the essence of the time and all that y'all endured for sure. But so I wanted to shift it to something a little more positive, and that is positive. Successful mission, saving lives, very cool stuff. Mike, what kinds of things are you involved in today? How do you spend your time today? I know some.
I'm of the theory you got to have a reason to get up in the morning. And sometimes I think I have too many reasons to get up in the morning. Jan and I, when we moved here, we had, other than our daughter and her family, we didn't know anybody in San Antonio area. And I think it was, I'm not sure what caused us to join the chamber as just private folks, not as a company. But we did, with the express purpose of getting to meet people. And then Mike Johnson mentioned something about this ambassador group with the chamber, and we applied for that and been doing that for 6+ years. But and then we have a Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association here in Santa, the Alamo chapter. And I was the president of that for a couple of years, and I'm the secretary for it now. But we get together once a month, try to. Sometimes we don't make it, but we get together as a group, and our wives are with us, and we have a lunch someplace. And then twice a year, we have a dinner someplace to include a Christmas party. So I'm quite involved in that, and I'm deacon at the church, and just with the Kiwanis group, probably takes more as much time as I do with the chamber, do all that stuff. But it's just one of those reasons that you have to have a reason to get up in the morning, especially at my age. What else am I going to do? Sit around and watch Netflix all day or do whatever? I'm not a gardener. I can't sit on the lake every day, although that would be tempting. But
you know what's fun, Mike? I was sitting there thinking about all of that. I see you involved in all those things, and there's so many more. You're right. It's not just that. And yet still the three of us also all serve together on this new veteran council inside the chamber. Yeah. And that's kind of fun because everything that you all, our listeners, are hearing Donna and I talk about on every episode, we really live in that out. I want you to know this really is who we are. So Mike is with us on this journey. We've stood up this council inside the chamber. We're going to begin serving veterans in the area and having a network of people to connect them to. And we're going to impact community through charities. The fact that Mike is the president of Kiwanis, like I mentioned earlier, one of the clubs in the area, they may be one of them we kind of champion for a year. But I think you're right, Mike. I think we have to continue to have things to do. I'm going to take it one step further real quick. So since you said you got to have a reason to get up, what's something you still aspire to do, Mike? You're a young man. What do you
My bucket list?
What's on the bucket list that hasn't come out yet?
Well, the biggest thing Jan has wanted to do for a long time, two things. One, she wants to go to the Northeast when the trees are turning.
Well, come on. I'm from New Hampshire. We've got 250 acres for you to
There's
go
the accent.
Around.
It just came out.
There, I'll get a hold of you, Donna. We'll talk about that.
All right.
And then want to take her to Israel.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I want to go with if y'all, I'll carry your bags, Mike.
I'm looking at maybe next year. Of course, everything, we have a lot of things planned this year that have gone by the wayside for reasons you already know about.
I do.
Yeah.
And that will be over with in September. And then, give her a bit of time to recover from all that. And then I've got a sister and extended family, if you would, in Oregon. Bend, Oregon. I'm going to go up there and see them. And my brother's having some pretty difficult medical problems, and I want to go see him in Phoenix and her family on her side of the equation. She has a brother who lives in Austin, and a sister is up in Odessa, and another brother in Alamogordo, New Mexico. We want to make sure we see all them. So we probably next year, good Lord willing, the creek don't rise, we'll do some traveling to get those kind of things. And I'm going to be 75 in a couple of weeks, and Jan's going to be 73 in September. And we got to get these things done before.
You're young.
Oh, yeah. Well, unfortunately, I've had a lot of check engine lights coming on here lately. that happens. I mean, it's going to happen to you guys, too. So,
I got a few that have popped up already.
Yeah, they start early on.
You're young at heart, though, Mike, and that's what I love. I love being around you because I see how much energy and zeal is the word, probably a better word, the zeal you have for life and serving and assisting others. And man,
and sharing your wisdom. I mean, we had a meeting the other day for part of the Veterans Committee there, and I asked Mike to come to it because I'm the chair of one subcommittee, he's the chair of another, and we all kind of cross. And he was there, and I think he was probably the most interactive one, to be honest.
Yeah. I'm just trying to
The thing that's kept me going big time, of course, is my wife. We've been married 53 years this year.
And hey, that's celebration worthy.
Yeah, it's August 22nd, be year 53. And she's been that solid rock on everything. If she hadn't have been there, some of the things we discussed about may have taken a different path. But she was there, and then accepting, and I don't want to go too religious on it, but I know where you guys come from, accepting God as my Lord and Savior. That was probably, and that happened in the 80s. I thought I was a Christian, but I wasn't till then. But with that, with those two factors in there as pillars of strength, the rest has been a piece of cake.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
Yeah, I love it. So we've got trips out to the Northeast with Donna to see trees changing colors. We've got a trip to Oregon plan, maybe get Israel in there. Mike, I like it. Those are some things I aspire to do as well. So
I think I want everybody in the audience to take away that, you know, things happen. You know, you came from an era that was a very tough era. If I had to look back on the military eras, Vietnam was probably one of the toughest ones for military veterans. And to watch how you have taken it and your mindset and how you've chosen to move forward. And even in the light that, you know, you were having struggles here and there that you may not have been consciously aware of, and many people are not. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have spouses, and that's why we have family, because they're so kind and they'll nicely whack you across the head and wake you up.
Yeah, right? They will.
Yeah, they will, right? Even when you don't want it, they nicely sit there and smile at you and tell you to get it together. But that support and that mindset of moving forward, and here you are at 75 and Jay's still trying to keep up with you. So, I mean, that's commendable. I mean, that really is commendable. And I really want the audience to hear that, because there are many people that are struggling. And I'm not saying it's all a cakewalk. And I hope nobody thinks that Mike just has this nice little cakey walk life. It was the mindset that he chose, how he chose to go about it, when he was hitting sticking points, listening to people that are saying, hey, this isn't working, and handling it, right? Yeah. There was no shame in it. You know, you went and had it handled and taking care of yourself and still moving forward. So I think that's an awesome example, yeah. You know?
No, thank you.
Yeah. Mike, anything that maybe we that didn't just come out, you know, over our coffee talk that you would want to share with the listeners? Anything on your heart?
You always ask those questions that I have to think about. Not right off the top of my head. You know, I guess the only thing I can that kind of crossed my mind is, if you think it's tough, it might be pretty tough right now. But depending on what you do about that, how you accept that particular situation and handle it, it will either get better or it won't. You can, what's the attitude? You know, what's your attitude towards it all? And then when I think we have it tough, talking with Jan, going through what she's going through because of her condition and what she's dealing with right now, that is opening a whole different world up to us that we knew was out there, but did not experience. Well, she now has quite a network of ladies that are experiencing the same thing she has. I have already and gotten through it. And some of them are really in bad shape. So even Jan's condition, compared to some of the other folks out there, piece of cake.
Well, you know what I think, Mike? I think listening to some of what you were sharing there, and it even ties back to the story earlier about, you know, getting the 9 service members out of that area and how tough that was. Up to this point in time, you, me, Donna, all 3 of us have faced storms. We've survived 100% of the storms we've faced up to this point. I think that's important for people to recognize. And so I appreciate that, your vulnerability in, you know, bringing that part in. And it really is an honor to know you, get to sit with you. I was thinking back to your comment earlier when you said, when we moved to San Antonio, other than our daughter and her family, we didn't know anybody. So we joined the chamber just to meet people. Donna and I hosted an episode. I don't remember when now even, but part of what we were telling people to do, look, get out in your community and just spend time meeting people, get involved in organizations. Kiwanis is one, a Chamber of Commerce is one, and you don't have to have a business to do that. Get out and connect with other people, because inside of that is where you may find opportunity.
Well, not only find opportunity, you know, I tell my kids all the time, when you're feeling down, give back, help people. Because giving is a form of therapy.
Yeah.
And within the giving, you start finding networks. And I don't mean professional networks that they're going to give you something. I just mean that support, right? Yeah. And so support is everything. I mean, in my last job, I took care of Guard and Reserve that were injured. And I saw the difference between people that had solid support and people that didn't have solid support, and how it affected them mentally, you know, and how much quicker they could recover with support and how much longer it took when they didn't have support. So if I can just get people to understand that, and you made a really good point, Mike, is that the situation you're in right now is temporary. It's not a permanent situation. And if you remind yourself of that, then that means there has to be a solution, and that should lead you to start finding these solutions. And sometimes we have to do what we're not trained to do, which is reach out and lean on each other. The teepee doesn't stand unless all poles are leaning in on each other, right? One pulls out and it all falls. So I just encourage our audience to reach out to each other. And in this technological era, the reach out is insane. We have more nonprofits, more hands out, more information that I think sometimes we just are so flooded that we are in overload, you know, we're in overdrive. And to me, you know, put the computer down and go out and talk to people and meet them and lean on them and be there for others. And I think it all just starts working itself out.
Yeah.
Well said.
Well, Mike, look, we sure enjoyed having you on this episode. We hope our listeners enjoy it. We just, you know, we want to express our love and gratitude for all the Vietnam era men and women. Thanks for your service. Know that there is a network of people out there. You heard Mike talk about groups that he still meets with, and I think that's really important. And, you know, I like to close this with a quote, and I didn't prepare for one, but just reflecting now, I think this is what comes to mind. It says, "You've not lived until you've done something for someone who will never be able to repay you."
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know who to attribute that to, so I don't want to even guess, but all the listeners, if that resonates with you, you can go out there and query that on Google and you'll get the right person to attribute it to. But I think that's what each and every one of us aspire to do. It's what we've done, and we're not done yet. And neither are you, listeners. We're not done yet.
I think I'm going to add that quote because one just popped in my head, which is so unusual for me because Jay always thinks of the quote.
You're the troublemaker. I'm the quote guy.
Right. Yeah. That's it. But the one that is, you know, you don't start living until you get out of your comfort zone. And I cannot say who said that. So not trying to plagiarize, but when we think of getting out of our comfort zone, it doesn't have to be in the sense of a new job that you've never done. It can be reaching out for help.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's pretty
one step outside that comfort zone. And there's an opportunity to grow and learn.
That's right.
I think it's really good.
All right.
Well, look, everybody, thank you again. We hope you continue to tune in, find value in what we're sharing. We're going to bring some more of these kind of discussions with people like Mike. But as always, we hope you're giving us a listen, a follow, and a share. On behalf of Beyond the Frontline, the Coming Home Well Network, my partner in crime, Donna Hoffmeyer, thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to talking with you soon.
Have an awesome day.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Frontline, a podcast of Coming Home Well. Join us every other Wednesday. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. Follow us on Instagram at @ComingHomeWell_BTS or on Twitter at @ComingHomeWell. Thanks again. And until all are home and all are well.